Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in History. I'm Marshall Poe, your host. Each week, we pick a new history book that we find particularly interesting, and we interview the author of that book. This week, I'm very pleased to say we have Ricardo Duchesne on the show, and we'll be discussing his new book, The Uniqueness of Western Civilization. It is one of the basic assumptions of the Western human sciences that material conditions are largely responsible for the development, and I mean that in the specific sense of organized movement through time, the development of history. This position is most famously associated with Marx, of course, but it is ubiquitous, I think, in what we might call the big picture social sciences. In this book, Ricardo Duchesne confronts that materialism directly in a very disruptive and interesting way, because what he says is that it is not material conditions, in fact, that have been the motor behind development, but it is, in fact, ideas. And he says even more radically that these ideas have been predominantly produced by one world historical culture, and that is the world historical culture that was founded by Indo-Europeans some 6,000 years ago. He says, and with some evidence, he's read everything, that these people were historically distinct and that they had a kind of culture that produced a sort of creativity that led to many of the things that we think of as Western and that have driven much of world history over the past 5,000 years. I'm sure that this book will be controversial. I found it extraordinarily thought-provoking. It truly made me question many of the things that I believed, and I hope that it receives a wide readership. So without further ado, here's the interview. Hi, Ricardo.
Hi, Marcia.
How are you today?
I'm doing good.
Good. I'm glad to hear that. Today we're talking to Ricardo Duchesne about his terrific new book, The Uniqueness of Western Civilization. This book, as I was telling Ricardo in the pre-interview, is a monumental achievement. It is obviously the result of many, many years of very deep thought and study. It is not likely that one arrives at a conclusion or a set of conclusions like the ones that Ricardo has arrived at. They are, to put it mildly, controversial, I would say. And as someone who has, on occasion, not many occasions, found himself in a situation where he had discovered something that did not conform to the conventional wisdom, I respect Ricardo very much for speaking out about this. You know, the data are what they are, and not as it might please us to imagine them. And so it takes a brave person, in addition to a great scholar, I think, to forward these arguments that he makes in the book. So I think he deserves our respect, first of all, in that this is an important part of democratic discourse. You know, I think it was John Stuart Mill that said, you have to get all the ideas out there if you're going to find the right ones. Yeah. So kudos to Ricardo. Ricardo, why don't you begin the interview before we talk about the book by telling us a little bit about yourself?
Well, as you can see from the accent, my mother tongue is Spanish. I was born in Puerto Rico, which is a small island in the Caribbean. And I came to Canada in my late teens and completed the last years of high school in Montreal, Canada. And so I completed also my university education in Montreal, except the PhD, which I did in Toronto. And now I'm here in New Brunswick, which is in the Atlantic side of Canada. And so in many ways, I would say I'm a Canadian. I have been living here now for over 30 years or so, I think. And that's what my life has been here, essentially, since the mid or late teens. And so about the book, how I came to write it.
Yeah, I was going to ask, why don't you tell us the origins of the book?
Well, I had always wanted to do a book on Europe, on the West, but I wasn't sure how to approach it. When I did my PhD dissertation, I did it on the famous Marxist debate on the transition to capitalism. They call it the transition from feudalism to capitalism. So that's what I wrote the PhD on. And I published some articles from it, but I wasn't really satisfied with what I had done. One of the reasons was that I was increasingly moving away from Marx's view of history and reading Max Weber and reading some other thinkers like Charles Tilly, Michael Mann, and so on. And I felt that the transition, that whole way of approaching Europe was inadequate, incomplete, that it tended to restrict our understanding of Europe in terms of class relationships and to view the state in terms of which class dominated it. And so I started reading and reading more and became, if you like, increasingly Weberian. At the same time, I was also always taken by Hegel and the philosophy of Hegel, which I studied quite seriously whilst I was doing my PhD. I studied with H.S. Harris, who is a very renowned authority on Hegel in the English speaking world. And I think that I would say that Hegel too came to play a big role in the way I was thinking about European history. If I could just very briefly say what was his importance, it was that he allowed me to see that Europe was not just about economic development, about technology, about the spread of power around the world, but that there was something related to the development of ideas, the way he connected what happened in ancient Greece to what happened in Rome to medieval Europe to early modern Europe all the way to the 19th century. He saw this connection that drew my attention, that this intellectual development was not fortuitous, disconnected, but there was something that was at work here, and that to understand Europe, you had to see this entire intellectual history. It wasn't simply a matter of looking at the Renaissance or the Enlightenment. And anyone who reads the book will notice right away that for me, Europe, the West, can never be reduced to one epoch, one phenomenon, be it the Reformation or the Industrial Revolution, but it is that sequence, that connection between major events and intellectual developments. So I would say that this is the way in which Hegel began to influence my thinking. But it took me a long time to really think how I would write a book on Western civilization. I think one of the missing elements was that I couldn't comprehend what started this. There was no answer in Hegel, or at least at that time, I couldn't find an answer that he would give me that was satisfactory as to how this dialectic of the mind evolved in Western Europe. And about 5 years ago, I would say that Nietzsche began to influence me. I began to see in him possibly a thinker that kind of saw that behind intellectual movements, behind ideas, these subterranean, irrational, passionate forces. And there is something of this in Hegel, as you can see from the book. But with Nietzsche, I got a sense that he was the one thinker who best articulated what I now call the aristocratic character of Western civilization. And so what I did next was to historicize Nietzsche, to try and find this aristocratic element. I mean, I see that aristocratic mentality in Nietzsche, but I don't see the sociology. I don't see the history. He does go back to the pre-Socratics, and he does give us many insights on the pre-Socratics, but it was only when I began to think about Indo-Europeans and the possibility that this group that scholars generally were not too keen to write about or speak about, which is why practically most of the books on Indo-Europeans are in the linguistics section and they're not in the prehistory section. So I started then about 4 or 5 years ago thinking about the Indo-Europeans, and from there it was like, yes, this is the, if you like, the starting point of the West. It became more and more obvious to me And this is what I try to do in one of the chapters there, or the last two chapters. I concentrate on that. So when that came together, that last piece, that is the Indo-Europeans, I felt comfortable to start seriously thinking about writing this book. Mm-hmm. So that's how I would say it came together.
I want to direct the discussion initially toward two things. One is the book doesn't actually begin with the Indo-Europeans, as you just pointed out.
Yeah.
It begins with the political context within which, I guess, world history and the West's place in it now resides. And it is both a scholarly and a political context which the findings of your book quite disagree with.
Yeah.
Yes. And so I wondered if you could talk a little bit about what has happened to the 19th century notion that the West, or particularly Western Europe, was really quite different than the rest of the world.
Yes, you're right to make reference to the first chapter, which is, I think, possibly the longest chapter, and it is an effort to trace the ideological roots of what I call multicultural world history and a movement away from the idea that the West was a unique civilization. In some ways, this was also what drove me to write this book. I wasn't aware of it, but around the late 1990s and early 2000-2001, I started realizing that people had, by and large, with the academic world, put out or seriously challenged the old Eurocentric model, which I took for granted even in my dissertation. The Marxist debate on the origins of capitalism is in many ways a Eurocentric model. It says that something in Europe was different, and that was the fact that capitalism emerged there in Europe first. And I took it for granted that Europe was different and so on. And the same thing when I moved into Weberian scholarship. But I started realizing by the late 1990s that a new group had emerged which had seriously challenged this. And I call them the multicultural or revisionist historians. And so in a series of articles that preceded this book, I took on their work, the work of Kenneth Pomeranz, Hobson, A.G. Franks, Patrick Manning, and others. And I realized that they were very, very influential, and more than that, that multiculturalism had become almost the official policy across academia, and that the West was being really pushed out and misinterpreted. So one of the things that I did first was to examine this literature, to take it seriously, to look at their evidence for months, every day, just looking at every factual statement they made. I decided that it was necessary to refute their arguments, did more and more research, I couldn't believe that people were accepting these arguments, because however well they were constructed, the evidence really was not there to support their arguments. So yes, in the first chapter, I addressed the rise of multicultural world history, and in subsequent chapters, I go about refuting the arguments of A.G. Frank, Pomeranz, and others. Among other things that I do in that first chapter, where I anticipate some of the things I'm going to say later. And another thing I do as well is that I also observe that this phenomenon of multiculturalism had deep roots in the academic intellectual history of the West. And I trace this back to anthropologists, to the critical school of Adorno and Horkheimer and others. I look into a whole range of other but you might say fads, like, well, it's not really a fad. It's actually a very influential movement. And I mean feminism, anthropological relativism, postmodernism, and I could see all the connections there. And so this is one of the things I also address in the first chapter, how all of these things came together and could be viewed as an assault on the identity of Western civilization.
Mm-hmm. I see. I want to ask the following question or make the following clarification, just in fairness to you and the people who will read the book. The points that you make are really two. One is that this historiography has a political context. That is, it is associated with a party or a set of ideas that were seeking power and gained power. But even more than that, I think, and importantly for the listeners of the show, you say that, I guess what I would call the people who claimed the West early on was not very different, and you mentioned Pomerantz and a bunch of other folks, are simply wrong on the facts. That they have, that empirically, you know, as historians, regardless of our political stripe, that they are simply wrong about this. Could you talk a little bit about what they say and why they're wrong?
Well, you're right. I mean, I felt that I didn't want to challenge them strictly from an ideological perspective. And also, I didn't want to reiterate what had been said before they came along. Pomerantz takes on Erik Jong's famous book, The European Miracle. He uses that book as a model of what the Eurocentric consensus is. And I challenge that as well. I say that you cannot pick one book and say this is the model, if only because there are many historians on Europe, on the Renaissance, the Reformation, the Enlightenment, that are, in my view, part of that model as well. But in any case, he uses Erik Jong's book and tries to refute it. And Pomerantz is quite effective. And this is one reason he became famous after he wrote his book, The Great Divergence, in the year 2000. And challenging him took me a long time. I had to go through all the claims that he made, and I had to find other sources that I felt he did not consult that question his arguments. And I would say that really when it all comes down to it, the basic difference is that I think that by the 1700s, England in particular, but some other regions in Europe as well, is showing clear signs that it is moving towards a post-Malthusian industrial society. Whereas Pomerantz, A.G. Frank, including Jack Goldstone, and there are slight differences between them, they argue that it is only after the 1750s and perhaps as late as 1820, 1830s that we can see definite signs that Europe is breaking away from the Malthusian past. Mm-hmm. So they argue that Europe, up until then, was moving along the same economic trajectory as many other regions in Asia were. And they do bring effective arguments to show that there were similar trajectories in these two areas of the world. So what I try to do, and this is what I spend most of my empirical effort, is to show that England, Europe, was clearly moving away from a Malthusian world. And when we say Malthusian, we mean a world in which the pre-industrial economy would reach limits to growth because output could not outpace the growth of population, and there would be declining returns in productivity and so on. So this gets into a lot of details about agricultural productivity, labor productivity, innovations, and so on. But as you add all these things up, it seems to me that England is moving away in the 1700s. It is doing so an accelerating pace by the third quarter of the 18th century, and clearly so by the 19th century. Now, the next thing that I do, in this is in chapter 2 and 3, is that I also show that this movement away from precedents in the past, that it is very difficult to link the scientific revolution and what Joel McHugh calls the Industrial Enlightenment. The Industrial Enlightenment is a term that Joel McHugh uses to link the Industrial Revolution of the 19th century with the Scientific Revolution of roughly the 17th century. And what it means essentially is that Europeans are using some of these ideas on mechanical motion and so on, to think of new ways to create instruments, to find new sources of energy and so on, and that they're doing this before the 1700s. Now, when you look at the economic indicators, the total output in, the economy in general, did it really increase right away? Well, no, it didn't. It was a long, drawn-out movement. And it's only by the 19th century that you see a sort of a number of indicators that are up to a decisive divergence from the rest of the world. You see a few of these in the 1700s, and you may not see any of this before the 1700s. But you do see many things. You see the exploration of the world, navigation, and you can use other indicators such as how many European ships navigated to Asia, at what rate were they increasing in the number of trips they took to Asia, and you look at the 1500s, 1600s, 1700s, and you see an acceleration in the number of ships that are coming from Europe to the other areas of the world. So this is sort of the kind of thing I do to counter pomerance. Yeah.
Yeah. Let's move to what I think is the next step in your argument against the revisionists or the multiculturalists, or I'm not quite sure what to call them. I don't want to call them names or anything like that. Many of them are great scholars, and in fairness to them and in fairness to you, you do acknowledge that. You acknowledge their contributions to this. So this is, I think, a pretty friendly scholarly debate.
Yes.
You say that they are wrong that Europe was not or did not show signs of being quite different as early as 1700, that you believe that it did, and that they believe that it didn't, but they are wrong. And then you begin tracing the origins of this, and I think really this gets to the nub of your what I think is really quite radical argument, and that is that what is behind this obvious divergence in your mind in the West is in fact a set of ideas and a way of being rather than I guess what we might generally call material forces.
Yeah, I do that. There's a series of steps. The first one is that I meet them in their own terrain, the revisionists. I look at the economics of Europe's difference, and I show that just looking at it in economic terms, that there is no question, as I just said, that by the 1700s, Europe is on a different path. Then after that, I not only connect that economic divergence to the scientific revolution and certain other aspects of European history in the modern, early modern era, but I also start arguing that the Industrial Revolution should not be the focal point around which we start distinguishing Europe from the rest of the world, that we should consider other developments. And for example, I will say that the scientific revolution, taken by itself without having to connect it to the Industrial Revolution, is a divergence. There is no scientific revolution elsewhere in the world. It is a whole new way of looking at the cosmos, of looking at the laws of nature and so on. So we cannot just look at Galileo, Newton, and a large number of other individuals that participated in this series of modern ways of thinking about nature and just judge these in terms of whether they contributed to the Industrial Revolution, but we have to judge them in their own terms and think of it as a whole new way of thinking about the universe. And so I do this with the Reformation, I do this with the Renaissance, I look at the printing revolution. I look at the paper revolution of the medieval era. I trace that paper revolution using a major work by, what is his name here? Harold Berman, Law and Revolution.
Legal history, yeah.
Yeah, so he connects that paper revolution to the rise of the modern state, modern law, the separation of church and state. Mm-hmm. So I open up the whole debate, and having opened up the whole debate, having looked at what Rome did, that was also very important, the invention of law, to use a very general expression, then what Greece did, then it becomes a big, big question. And from that way of thinking, I start asking, well, how did all these things happen? Why did Europe experience all these discontinuities? And why were they so persistent, mm-hmm. happening throughout history? Because, I mean, if you read the history of Europe, and not just economics, politics, or even just science, but read the history of literature, of poetry, of architecture, of philosophy. You have to read the history of philosophy. You know, a work like Bertrand Russell's The History of Western Philosophy, to me, is just as important as any economic history of Europe. From that work, you will learn a lot about a culture, a civilization that produces this sequence of thinkers, one after the other, each saying something different from what the one said before. And depending on who you read, some will say, well, Leibniz was so revolutionary. He introduced a whole new way of thinking in terms of nomads. Then comes Spinoza, or around the same time. And then you have Kant, and he's the one who really invented the notion of a moral individual agent. And then the Hegelians will say, well, no, Hegel is just as revolutionary. And then you go backwards to Luther, and you can go within literature itself. There are many literary movements. Just looking at the history of England, you'll have volume after volume about the literature of the Victorian age, of the Restoration England, the Middle Ages, and within each of these periods there are different writers, and they are also themselves quite original and unique. With music, it's the same. In fact, when it comes to classical music, that's a phenomenon that you only see in Europe. There is no classical music elsewhere in the world. And you can say, well, okay, but, you know, everybody has their own differences and they have their own music. But even if you accept that and you look at the history of classical music in Europe, well, again, it is quite innovative. It is quite creative. Not always, not in every epoch, but generally has that pattern of persisting creativity. Some centuries show a lot more of it, like the 18th, 19th century. Some show less, but you can open a book on the history of Western music, and what strikes the reader, if you're thinking of what makes the West different, is this ongoing history. It has a history. There is a literary history. There is a history of poetry, and I don't find that in other areas of the world, not as much, at least. Mm-hmm. If I could say that minimal statement, that you don't find as much in all other areas of the world.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I wanted to ask a question before we move on to your explanation of this continuous creativity, which in itself is radical, and I think people will find fascinating, and that is that one of the things that you say about modern historical and I guess also sociological and political scientific scholarship is that it is really very materialist in its orientation. That I almost want to say, and these are not your words, that many of these people are crypto-Marxists and they don't even know it.
Oh, yes,
that
yeah.
they think of humans as very reactive, that the only time a human will do something is when it is forced to do it by material circumstances, that there is no creative spark. Maybe you could talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, that's one of the other things I do in the first chapter, that I noted that for all the differences that you may find between Jared Diamond and Michael Mann and even people that one calls the variants, and some of the people who argue against the revisionists, people like Eric Jones, Pomeranz, and all of them, including anthropologists that I mentioned, and many postmodernists, there is a strong tendency to view human beings as reactive creatures, and more so now than ever. The history of humans is fundamentally shaped by external forces. And someone like Diamond will say geographic forces. Someone else will say biology. Someone else will say economic structure of the world system. And they debate each other. But by and large, they don't want to really focus on individuals themselves. And they do occasionally here and there and acknowledge it. That's not really their preoccupation. And especially when they're thinking of big, long-term transformations, they think, well, those things, those big things cannot have been brought about by individuals. And one of the things I do in the book is that I go way back to, let's say, the origins of agriculture. And I argue that one of the main agents, the persona that was quite critical in bringing about agriculture or farming were these so-called aggrandizers, these individuals who wanted more, that wanted to gain more prestige within the village, that wanted more attention on themselves. And this is an important agent, and they're active, they are energetic, and they may have attributes that we dislike, like greediness and self-interest. Yes, so you're right. There is that in the book. I do this. And I also argue there that these individuals are more noticeable in European history. And I trace that back to the aristocratic culture of Indo-Europeans, individuals who are trying to find new ways, struggling to make a name, to think in a different way. You go back to ancient Greece and you will see the pre-Socratics. Thales will say it is water. Anaximenes will say it is some other element, be it earth, and somebody else comes along and says, no, it is air. And then Empedocles comes and says, no, it is all those four together. And then Heraclitus says it's becoming. Parmenides, he says it is being. And it's quite interesting how they are, arguing with each other. And as they're doing that, they're, offering us with new ways of thinking. And in my view, really developing our ability to understand things. Mm-hmm. Because one doesn't have to be a weak historian, or one doesn't have to think that development is natural and it is bound to happen, to realize that there is here in the history of the West some kind of sequence, some kind of dialogue that is going on, that when Aquinas comes along, he's not just putting forth a view that's one more and you can take it or leave it, depending on what your standpoint is, but rather he's thinking through prior thinkers. He's thinking through Aristoteles and trying to absorb the significance of Christianity and to make sense of it. So then Aquinas can be seen in light of what preceded him. And then people who come later can also be seen in that light. Like if the nominalists reject the universalists, or the people who believe in universals, they reject them, but in a state of dialogue with those people that preceded them. And then they in turn have a influence on what happens later. And so this is something that I assimilated or learned from Hegel, because this is how he views the history of he calls it the human mind. But one of the arguments I make in that chapter on Hegel is that we should think of Hegel's Phenomenology of the Spirit as being a book on the phenomenology of the spirit, because essentially that's what it is. You cannot write a phenomenology of any other culture. Now, Hegelians today have become so multicultural themselves that, oh, they want to talk about the phenomenology of other cultures like Iran and so on, but no one has written it, and no one will, because you can't do it, because you have to have that developmental pattern, mm-hmm. that energy and dialectic has to be there. Mm-hmm. For one to write such a phenomenology.
Mm-hmm. I have to say that, let me ask you a question. You may not be prepared for it, but it strikes me that it is a great irony that we, and I think I would include Canada here, we here in the United States and Canada and the Western world in general live in a culture that worships creativity. We yeah. love creativity. The way that we teach our kids, I mean, I've lived in other countries where they do not teach children to be creative. We actively, and I have children myself, actively teach them to do new things, things that other people did not do. And yeah. we highly prize that. Yet our entire explanation of how we got to this point seems to be materialist. That yeah. is that it had nothing to do with creativity, that it was forced on us in some way.
Yeah.
How do you explain that exactly?
It will require a long explanation, and you will still not be able to fully answer it. And this is what we can talk about that later, but what I will try to do in the next book. And I think it's something that itself emerged out of the West, because we have to understand that multiculturalism is a Western creation. This obsession with diversity, this ongoing effort to downplay, to minimize, to neglect Western achievements is itself a Western phenomenon. Mm-hmm. So it came out of the West. And I say that an element here is that we became increasingly uncomfortable with the notion that our culture, the Western culture, could have been so much more creative than others, that idea went against notions of egalitarianism, of democracy. It also went against, welcome ideas about showing understanding and appreciation for other cultures, which itself is a Western phenomenon. Anthropology was created by Westerners themselves. The study of the history of other cultures is itself a Western phenomenon. It is as if we don't want to acknowledge and admit something that we did because we think it is unfair, it is egoistical, we tend to have a short memory historically. We sometimes think that imperialism was a European creation, that racism was created by Europeans, and we forget, therefore, the way other societies also participated in empire creation. Although, mind you, in the book, I do say that Westerners have exhibited a more expansionary temperament throughout history. They have been more aggressive than other peoples, and that's part of individualism. And that brings me to the next point, which is that, and this is something Nietzsche saw, there is a dark side to creativity. There is a dark side to individualism. And it is that it doesn't come in a state of harmony and balance, but it presupposes imbalances, and it seeks to create tension, and the element of strife there, of moving against something, mm-hmm. of challenging it and bringing something else. Schumpeter, when he spoke about capitalism, he came up with this idea of creative destruction. That is itself, in my view, a continuation of that temperament that I trace back to the Indo-Europeans. This early 19th century entrepreneur and the robber barons in the United States were of that type, immensely creative, ambitious individuals, and we feel comfortable with them. Mm-hmm. Here in Canada, we have someone like Conrad Black, who exhibited certain tendencies that were too self-absorbed. Their mannerisms upset us. They seem too arrogant, the way they walk and handle themselves. And so, people like that sometimes will do things that get them into trouble because they may have too much energy. They cannot be controlled by all these rules and regulations that modern liberal societies have created and all the bureaucracies continually telling you got to fill this and fill that to do the next thing and the next thing. So we lock them up. So, you could see it that way. I mean, I see this everywhere. I see it in motorcycle gangs, the fact that Westerners have this, the Hells Angels and then other gangs, and they want to do their own thing. And there's an element of rebelliousness there. And they conflict with each other a lot. So I say that makes us uncomfortable. And we academics live in a very sort of serene, calm, not always, but there is an element of serenity. For one, our incomes are assured. we get tenure. So we start projecting that onto history, and we want history to be that way.
Yeah. I'm laughing, but there's something to that. I won't wax autobiographical here, but there really is something to that. There's an easy Nietzschean interpretation of this, this conflict in Western civilization between incredible creativity and the desire to tamp it down, and that is that the Western society is Christian predominantly, yes, and that Christianity is the religion of slaves.
Yeah, that's, Nietzsche says that. I raise that question when Nietzsche says that with Socrates and after Euripides and what he called the Alexandrian civilization of the Hellenistic era, he sees a watering down of the creative energy in the Greek world. He doesn't quite explain how is it that Rome then rises up and so on, but in any case, in Christianity, he really sees a rebellion, a revolt by the slaves against aristocratic individuals. Mm-hmm. But I think that Christianity started to accommodate itself to that creativity. It began to appreciate it. And not only that, we also see new infusions of pagan aristocratic bands coming into Europe. When Rome starts to decline, these barbarian people filled with energy take over. And so it's not as if Rome or the West comes to an end with Rome. Many people today, when they talk about Western civilization, they say, well, that we're going to face a situation like Rome, that Rome declined and the barbarians, took over. I don't agree with that because I think Rome had already lost its vitality, that it was a good thing for the barbarians to come in and that revitalized the West. And Christianity played a critical role in sublimating some of these pagan impulses and redirecting them into more educational or civilized efforts. You see this in England with Alfred the Great. You see it with Charles the Great, with the Carolingian Empire. To me, these are efforts to, subdue to some degree the excesses, the barbarism of these pagans and make it more civilized, and we then eventually get all this creativity coming out of Christendom with the invention of universities, philosophy, cathedrals, great works that really connect to the scientific revolution, new ideas on on matter and motion, come on from Christendom, the rise of towns, and so on. So yes, I wouldn't say that Christianity brought all that down, as Nietzsche seems to say. The creativity is still there. I think we are now finally really experiencing the real decline that it is this generation more than any other. Spengler was right in the 19th century to see that it is there evident in the 19th century with democracy or modern liberalism. It is there and socialism. But I would say that after the Second World War is when all the elements that go against Western energy and creativity somehow come together and give us the world we have now.
Yeah, no, I do find it striking that, you know, on the one hand, I will tell my son, you know, to go out there and to compete and to do well and to be creative and to really make something of himself. And then I tell him, and by the way, the meek shall inherit the earth. I don't know how to put these things in my mind together.
No, I'm the same. You feel guilty. You don't want him to be too aggressive.
Right, exactly.
You think that might do him harm.
Yeah,
I struggle with that. I have my son. I have him boxing now, to learn to box. And I think one of the reasons I'm critical of feminism is that I think it is part of this effort to subdue and downplay the male side of Western civilization, because it is as if they feel, well, this is their last obstacle. Mm-hmm. If only we emasculate male, then we'll finally get this harmonious world we want.
Mm-hmm.
But that there is a reaction that is growing. Although that's a whole new topic there, but you will have noticed that I do bring up the male component in the rise of the West.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I did notice that. Yeah. So let's go actually in the closing minutes of the interview to really the empirical nub of the book. And that is that the origins of this continuous creativity that you claim exists can be found actually in the invasion of the European continent by a group of people, a kind of mysterious group of people, as you say yourself, called the Indo-Europeans. Maybe you could talk a little bit about that.
Yes. I didn't know the Indo-Europeans 5 years ago. I heard about them and so on, like everybody did. But when you go back to ancient Greece, and you're there in classical Greece, and you look at what people are saying about classical Greece, how did this happened. They call it the Greek miracle. Now, remember what I said earlier, that I had come to the conclusion that it was not just the Renaissance, Industrial Revolution, or the Enlightenment, but it was this sequence of immensely creative epochs in Western history. Now, the first epoch is classical Greece. So it would stand to reason that to go back there to trace the origins is important. So when I study various books as to how it came about that Greece produced this miracle, there were really no answers. Many of them were similar to the ones that were being offered for the rise of modern Europe. That is, they argued that Greece was divided into small city-states, that they were very competitive with each other, and that this competition engendered this kind of creativity. But there are problems here. For one, the notion that this kind of division by itself will engender philosophical and literary creativity is not one that you can support, because you find it in other areas of the earth as well, or other areas in the world. And at other times, like India, you'll find that there were certain divisions between different territories. In China, there was a period, it's called the period of the warring states, where there was a lot of competition between different states. And it's also the case that just because there is competition per se, you're not going to get creativity. We're just talking about strife and so on, but that is a major ingredient. But one has to understand the nature of that competition. It isn't just the chaos or the violence that produces creativity. There has to be a mindset, a psychological disposition. And when I started studying this more, I began to think about the people who preceded the classical Greeks. As you know, there is a dark age there in Greece that runs from around 1200 to around 800 BC. But before 1200, you have Mycenaean civilization. And when you study the Mycenaeans and you study their culture, it became transparent to me that they were quite aristocratic, quite energetic. They had spread themselves throughout the Mediterranean, and that they had what I saw was an aristocratic culture. And by aristocratic culture, I mean that there is an elite that rules the society. Even if there is an individual that has more authority and more power, that individual rules together with these other powerful aristocrats. By aristocratic, I mean an attitude, a sense that I'm not going to be allowed to be subdued or mistreated as an inferior. And that's something that I observed did happen in other civilizations, in Chinese, Indian, Aztec, and so on. The aristocracy, even when you call it aristocracy, they didn't have this a temperament of rebelliousness and adventurism or seeking adventure, mm-hmm. and challenging things. So, you know, I started really then just reading books on the Indo-Europeans, and I felt that there was something there. And I'll just put it this way. First of all, they have a different economy. When you look at farming arrives in Greece around 6,500 BC, and then by around 5,800, you see herding and farming aging in that area of the Pontic Caspian steppes, and it is from the Pontic Caspian steppes that the Indo-Europeans came. There is still some debate. Some people think they came around where Armenia is today, but I accept what I think is the stronger consensus, which is that they came from where Ukraine is today, or the Pontic Caspian steppes. Then by around 5,200 and 4,800, you see the spread of cattle, farming, sheep, and essentially you see a pastoral herding economy there. So although farming had come into Greece in the 7th millennium, and from there it spread into the Balkans and also westwards into Europe gradually, in the Pontic steppes you see farming coming in, but there it takes on a herding pastoral character as well. Essentially it means that animals play a bigger role there in that area. Mm-hmm. Then the next important phenomenon is that we have an animal there that today we call the horse, that was found in the Pontic Caspian steppes. And this animal is domesticated after 4800 BC, thereabouts. And I'm going quickly over these days because we don't have much time.
Yes,
and then by 4200 BC, David Anthony has made the argument, and others are agreeing, that writing could be detected by 4200 BC, and certainly by 3700 BC. Then you have wheeled vehicles by 3500 BC or 3000 BC. Now, if you take this together, the pastoral economy, riding of horses, and wheeled vehicles by 3500 BC, 3000, all these things are put together, then you have a whole new economy that is quite mobile. And this economy does start moving into the Balkans and westwards into Europe. Initially, there are intrusions, sporadic, but nevertheless, for sure, there were regular interactions. But by 3800 into 3000 BC, you see a whole horizon. They call it the Yamnaya horizon between 3300 and 2500 BC of this pastoral economy in around the Balkan region, a bit into central Europe. And then later on, you see the Cordillera culture, which is, if you like, the pre-Germanic culture, and is the ground out of which the Bronze Age Europe comes. And these cultures are very dynamic. They have horses. They ride them. They cover extensive territories, and eventually, later on, you will see the rise of chariots. The earliest in the steppe can be said to have been there before 2000 BCE. And there's a lot of debate as to whether the Near East originated them, but some people say that the earliest can be seen in the steppes before 2000 BCE, whereas in the Near East, they were unknown before 1800 BCE. So I tend to agree with those who think that it was invented or at least made proper for riding and warfare by people from the steppes. So when you put this package together, you have a very formidable, expansive a culture. And this is one of the things that I try to do in that chapter, to show this, how they expanded, and to show that continuously when you read the sources, not me, but when you read David Anthony, when you read Mallory, even if they disagree about where they came from and so on, when you read Marie Hakim Vutas, who is known as a feminist scholar, and she views these Indo-Europeans as warlike pastoral peoples, when you read all of these sources, they all seem to agree that this was a aristocratic culture, very warlike, very mobile, very aggressive. And I started asking myself, why do they keep saying aristocratic? And they say the same thing about the Mycenaeans, that they're aristocratic. And they say the same about the Homeric Greeks. There are aristocrats there. One of the things about Homer's Iliad is that you can actually identify people by their names, mm-hmm. which is not to be found elsewhere. And it's not just one name, the name of a king. It's the name of many, many individuals. And they have lineages. They have places that they own. They have wives with names and sons with names. So you see this individualization. And if you go earlier back to, 3000 BCE, you already see many of the old aristocratic features. I have a section there. I think I raised about five major points as constituting an aristocratic culture, having to do with the way they dress, having to do with the way they related to each other when they form warrior bands, that they see themselves as a group of comrades, as a war band of men that are each seeking some glory and each loyal to the other. And although there is one who pulls together these men together and he's the leader, the other ones are also quite individualistic in searching their own glory, in having a reputation and a name. And I connect this then to the heroic literature. It's very interesting that only Europeans produce a heroic literature. The Iliad is one, but we have others associated with the Celt, the Germanic peoples. And so I try and look at all these common patterns, and I call it, for that reason, an aristocratic culture. Mm-hmm. It's a long discussion that you cannot sum up quickly.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you, we're almost out of time, but I really am finding this very interesting. It seems to me that your position rests on three points, that is, relative to the contribution of the Indo-Europeans to a unique Western civilization. The first one is that there were these Indo-Europeans, and that they are of the character you say they were. Let's leave that one aside, as we've talked about it a little bit. The second is that these Indo-Europeans, if they are as you say they are, were in fact different from other contemporaneous or later or earlier, I suppose, warrior elites that we find scattered around the globe, that they were truly were had a different character. And then the third thing, and I also want you to hear you speak about this just briefly, is that there's a mechanism of transmission of the values, aristocratic values that they held, that basically comes down to our day. So I guess the questions I have are two. One is, were these Indo-Europeans truly unique? And two, is there an identifiable mechanism of transmission across the generations?
Yeah, well, one of the most difficult questions is, how do I get from a barbaric, militaristic, aristocratic culture to the Greek miracle? How do we make that transition? Mm-hmm. And I spend time handling that, and I get into philosophical discussions. I even talk about the origins of genuine personalities. I even argue that that self-consciousness emerged with the Indo-Europeans. Mm-hmm. And what I mean by that is the ability for us to be able to make distinctions between those things within ourselves that are mental or conscious things and those things that relate to our body, to our appetites. And that by the time you get to Plato, there's a clear tripartite division of the soul. Yeah. If you go back to the pre-Socratic and the Homeric characters, for sure, it isn't clear how they distinguish things that we associate with the mind and things we associate with the body. So I do trace that to the Indo-Europeans, and that's a complicated, long discussion that I go through Kojève and using Nietzsche as well, the sublimation of willpower. So, you know, we would have to have a specific questions, and I could go point by point. I'm afraid that if I make a general statement, mm-hmm. it sounds a bit outlandish. Yeah, but I'm persuaded by the fact that there is something about seeking personal renewal, about distinguishing oneself as an individual away from a group, away from a collective, that is associated with a more intense awareness of oneself, and that this intense awareness is associated with a creativity and differentiation. And as I mentioned before, you see it in Homer, the fact that he's identifying characters with names, and this is not there in any other culture. It is not just one king who does everything, who accomplishes everything. When you read, and I've read quite a few of the announcements, statements that the kings of Mesopotamia made throughout their history, the Akkadians and so on, it's very much focused on one individual doing everything. This is not the case in the Homeric Greeks, and it is not the case in the Celtic and Germanic and Norwegian myths. You see a number of characters there with name. And so, you know, I don't want to say that automatically there is going to be a point at which we differentiate the mind, and then we become aware of reasoning as something that is distinctive to ourselves, and that out of that develops philosophy. I don't want to say that that is bound to happen, but I cannot see how you could disconnect the two. But historians are very skeptical of these kinds of arguments, and all I can say is you have to read the book and see what's there and make your own judgment about this.
Well, I hope that a lot of people read the book. Unfortunately, we're going to have to leave it at that because we're out of time. It's been really interesting talking to you. I want to close with our final question on New Books in History, and that is, what is your next project? What are you working on now, Ricardo?
Well, what I'm going to do next I think it's going to be about the decline of the West, to address that question again. And I already started reading, and there's a big debate, as you know, about this. And it also relates to the question you asked earlier, why do Westerners know that creativity is good and yet somehow feeling comfortable with acknowledging mm-hmm. their own historical creativity. Mm-hmm. And I think I will try to answer questions like that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I can't wait to read the answer because then I'll know how to raise my son.
Yeah. It's so hard. Yeah. I know.
So anyway, Ricardo Duchesne, thank you very much for being on the show today. I really enjoyed talking to you.
All right. Thanks.
All right. Bye-bye.
Okay.
You've been listening to an interview with Ricardo Duchesne about his book, The Uniqueness of Western Civilization. I'm Marshall Poe, the host of New Books in History. I hope you have a great week.